Okay, good evening, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's October 2nd, and we're going to start a new chapter today, Chapter 7, Structure of the Nervous System. We're going to learn about action potentials and neurons and neuroglia. A lot of this first part is actually kind of a review from anatomy already, so if you're a little rusty on this, you got to break your anatomy books out and reread your anatomy, but hopefully it comes back to you really quick. So I would guess, even though you're going to study over the weekend for the test that we have on Tuesday, you should probably review some of the stuff that we're looking at today, because it should come back to you pretty quick. All right, so don't spend all your time studying for the test. Keep up with the class, too. All right, so does anybody have any questions on the test? Same kind of format as last time, web questions, end of the chapter questions, exam figures, right? And I'm sorry? And the objectives are real important, sure, because when I pick questions for you to look at, it should match up with an objective. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's get started. And I was talking with Dr. Ogoshi, and there seems to be some students that are coming to lecture, but maybe not lab. And that's a little bit of a problem as far as staying in the class. So if that might be one of you, and I'm not sure who it is, but maybe over the weekend I'll talk with Dr. Ogoshi and see who that is. And just make sure you keep going to both classes. Okay? All right. All right, so let's look at some structures of the nervous system, all right? But basically, the nervous system can be divided into two main huge divisions, and that is the central nervous system versus the peripheral nervous system. And the central nervous system is just the brain and the spinal cord, and peripheral is what? Everything else outside the brain and spinal cord. And that includes cranial nerves as well as spinal nerves. Where do spinal nerves come from? Where do they originate? Okay, spinal nerves come from the spinal cord, and cranial nerves come from the brain, right, and from the brainstem. Okay, and the nervous system or nervous tissue consists of two kinds of cells. The two cells are neurons and neuroglia cells, or glial cells, or neuroglial cells, and these are the support cells. And for years and years and years, scientists were only interested in neurons because these were the cells that transmitted electrical information over really long distances, and they didn't pay much attention to the support cells. But now recently we're very interested in these supporting cells, and we'll give you some evidence as to why that is. But nonetheless, neurons still are considered the functional units of the nervous system because they carry electrical information very quickly over very long distances. Right, and the glial cells maintain homeostasis. They maintain the nervous system and to a large degree how it functions. There are five times more common than neurons. So there are many more glial cells than there are neurons. All right, so let's take a look at a neuron. They gather and transmit information. So a neuron has a receiving part and it has a sending part to it. They receive stimuli and respond to stimuli, and then they produce and send electrochemical impulses. And when that impulse reaches the end of a neuron, it releases a chemical message. Okay, so what I would really like for you to focus on, when we talk about a nerve impulse, I would like really for you to think of that as an electrical event. All right, you're going to see that it involves ions, which are chemicals, and so a lot of people like to think of them as an electrochemical kind of event, but if I was going to pick one or the other, I would say electrical. And the messages that these neurons release, right, definitely are chemicals. So impulses, think of as electrical information, but when this signal goes from one neuron to another, think of it as a chemical. Right? I think that's even a better way of thinking about it. All right, so neurons have a cell body. What's another name for a cell body? Anybody remember another name for a cell body? That's the soma of this neuron right here. And these very small projections are what we call dendrites. I'm getting closer to my receiver over here. Okay, so these are dendrites. And the cell body and dendrites are the receiving end of a neuron. They receive signals. And then these signals are relayed to this other very long projection coming out of the neuron, and this is what we call an axon. And the axon is the sending part of a neuron. So neurons have these two parts, the receiving part, which is dendrites and cell body, and the sending part is this axon. And the axon is usually a lot longer. Now, these cells, of course, are microscopic. You can't see them underneath the microscope, but nonetheless, they can be extremely long. They can be a meter long, maybe 2 meters long, but they are still microscopically thin, so you can't see them. All right? But they can go all the way from your spinal cord to the tip of your toe, for instance, which is a really long distance, really huge in terms of a cell. And electrical information always goes from dendrites to cell body and then down an axon to the axon terminus over here. Right? Electrical signals, or the way that a neuron communicates, is never from an axon terminus or terminal up an axon to the cell body and out a dendrite. So information is transmitted like a one-way street, sort of like transcription, or sort of like protein synthesis. Remember, that was a one-way street. So this neuron right here is a typical multipolar kind of neuron that probably should be on the tip of your tongue already from anatomy. And this one down over here is what we call a unipolar. Or in some books call it a pseudo-unipolar, because there's just one process coming out of it that then bifurcates into two. So this multipolar neuron is found in a motor pathway, for instance, and association neurons. Association neurons are in the central nervous system, and a motor neuron, the cell body is in the central nervous system, but the axon leaves, it goes out through the root of the spinal cord and into a nerve someplace in your body where it reaches some effector organ. This unipolar or pseudo-unipolar neuron is a sensory neuron. So this is the end. These dendrites over here are going to be maybe on the surface of your skin someplace to appreciate some kind of sensation. So this is what we call the peripheral process, and it brings the information in toward the spinal cord. And this cell body is going to join thousands or tens of thousands of other cell bodies in the dorsal root as it enters the spinal cord. And so that group of cell bodies there in the dorsal root is what we call the dorsal root ganglia. So you're probably familiar with that. And then this is the central process, right? This axon right here that goes into the central nervous system. So again, this is the direction of signal from the dendrites up to the cell body and then out the axon into the central nervous system. The cell body is the nutritional center, and it makes macromolecules, including maybe neurotransmitters and other things that the neuron needs. Groups of cell bodies in the central nervous system are called a nucleus. So in this particular case, right, dendrites and nerve cell bodies are not myelinated, and so they have a tendency to look gray inside the central nervous system. So a nucleus inside the central nervous system has a gray appearance. But there's also white matter in the central nervous system, and white matter is a result of a group of axons that are going someplace, and if they are myelinated that we see right here with these Schwann cells, then this part of the neuron actually looks white. And so that would be white matter in the central nervous system someplace. Right? Nonetheless, a group of cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system is called a ganglia. So what's the difference between a nucleus and a ganglia, or a ganglion? Yeah, they're a group of cell bodies. But how would you think about what's the difference? Why would you want to use these two different terms? That's right. It's only by location, right? The central nervous system has the nucleus, and the peripheral nervous system has the ganglia. But structurally, they're very similar. They're just in two different places of the nervous system. All right, so this area here is going to look gray, but if it's myelinated, it's going to look white. And that's why we have white matter and gray matter in the central nervous system. So don't forget, dendrites receive information and convey it to the cell body. Axons conduct impulses away from the cell body down to the axon terminus. And we're going to look and see what the different electrical properties of this neuron have in these two different locations. And it's going to be due to different kinds of channels that are in the membrane, different kinds of channels. Okay, so this long axon length necessitates a special kind of transport system because things can't move by diffusion all the way from, for instance, your spinal cord down to your little toe. So there is exoplasmic flow. This moves soluble compounds, these are solutes that are dissolved in solution, down toward the nerve endings. And exoplasmic flow, you could think of as, for instance, a way to model this in your mind as a peristaltic wave down your digestive tract. It just happens via rhythmic contractions of the axon, and it just pushes fluid down toward the axon terminus. Okay, so this is a very slow process compared to the propagation of a nerve impulse, but nonetheless, this can bring macromolecules down into the axon terminus. A second way is via axonal transport. So this first one was exoplasmic flow. It's actually the flow of fluid. And the second one is actually a special kind of transport that is actually requiring special protein molecules to act as little motors that move things around inside the cell. So axonal transport moves large and insoluble compounds bidirectionally along the axon via a microtubule system, and this is relatively fast. And remember, we said in the microtubule system that they're like a monorail system. Various organelles can be moved around inside the cell. Chromosomes can be moved around inside the cell while hopping rides on the microtubule system of the spindle apparatus during mitosis. So microtubules are just kind of a standard way that a cell has available to it to move things around, including things down that very long passageway through an axon to an axon terminus. Okay, so things can move two ways. We said bidirectionally. They can move from the cell body down to the axon terminus, or they can move things from the axon terminus back up into the cell body, either direction. So it's bidirectional. It's not like an electrical impulse. So when it goes from the cell body down to the axon terminus, we call that anterograde transport. Anterograde is just a real fancy term for a forward direction, forward from the cell body to the axon terminus. And the kind of motor protein that's used is called a kinesin. Kinesin is responsible for forward transport, or what we call anterograde transport. Furthermore, things can be transported actively from the axon terminus back up into the cell body, and we call that backward transport, but I don't ever want you to use that term. I would like for you to use the term retrograde. And what does retrograde mean? It means backwards, right? It means backwards flow. So retrograde transport moves material back toward the cell body. And it uses a different kind of motor protein. These are what we call dynenes. Right? So dynenes move things retrograde, kinesins move things anterograde. So what's probably really important that you'd learn this terminology, anterograde versus retrograde. And you might have a question on these motor proteins, but that's kind of a secondary concern of mine, that you know the nomenclature. Okay. And as a matter of fact, these dynein molecules are responsible, even viruses use them to gain entry to the cell body once they get inside the axon terminus, and so they can hop a ride and actually get transported into the cell body where they can take over the nuclear functions and then take over the functioning of the whole cell. And toxins also can make their way into the central nervous system this way. Right, so this is different than exoplasmic flow, because exoplasmic flow is only, let's see if I can go back, is only unidirectional, right? It moves things to the nerve endings, but axonal transport is what? Bidirectional due to these motor proteins. All right, so we can classify neurons by not only their shape, but also by their function, right? Not only by their anatomy, but by their physiology as well. So some neurons conduct information from the periphery into the central nervous system. So we see a nice figure right here. And this, what color is this? Is this like beige? Green? Did you say green? Okay, this green area right here just symbolizes the peripheral nervous system, and this blue area over here symbolizes the central nervous system. All right, so a sensory neuron like this unipolar neuron has receptors associated somehow and is bringing information in toward the central nervous system. And another and more proper name for sensory fiber is an afferent fiber, right, or an afferent pathway. And I'm misspeaking a little bit because usually you want to say afferent, but if I say afferent compared to efferent, sometimes real quickly in class, it's, you might mix them up, right? So I overemphasize afferent versus efferent. So afferent is always going to be sensory, and other fibers are going to take information from the central nervous system into the peripheral nervous system, and we call those motor fibers or motor pathways, and these are what? The efferent neurons that carry impulses away out of the central nervous system. And just for fun, can you tell me what kind of spinal roots these two different pathways use? Which spinal root is always sensory? Well, I tell you what are the two roots on the spinal cord? What are the two roots on the spinal cord? Can you, anybody remember? This is a blast from the past. When did you guys take anatomy? Okay. So there's what? There's a ventral root and a dorsal root. Two different roots. The dorsal root is in the back, right? The ventral root is the anterior root, and the dorsal root is the sensory, and the ventral is the motor root. So this unipolar neuron is coming in the dorsal root, and this motor is leaving the ventral root, but it's not shown at all on this slide graphically, okay? I don't see any roots on this slide. All right, the other interesting thing that we do have on this slide is a third kind of functional classification, and that is an association neuron. We also call these interneurons. They don't carry signals to and from the central nervous system, but they deal with signals once they are inside the central nervous system. And so they integrate nervous system activity. They make decisions for us. And so these association neurons are the only kind of neurons that are completely and only found inside the nervous system, the central nervous system. They're not part in the central nervous system, part peripheral nervous system. They're completely 100% within the central nervous system. That's the only kind of neuron that is. All right, so they integrate and make decisions. All right, so we kind of went over these already. So here is a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar, which is a good example of a sensory neuron. And then here is a motor neuron over here, the multipolar, has many dendrites and one long axon. These are also the form that association neurons have. So motor and association or interneurons are multipolar. And then the third kind, which we haven't talked about yet, are these true bipolar neurons right here. We're going to look and see, maybe in anatomy you saw these, but we didn't make a really big deal out of them. You see these associated with the special senses, organs for special sensation. Can anybody remember what a special sense is in your body?
Yeah.
The eyes, definitely special sense. We have bipolar neurons there. Olfaction is a special sense. There are bipolar neurons there as well. So special senses sometimes employ bipolar neurons to do a job. Okay, they're never motor, but sensory. And they're going to be in the peripheral nervous system someplace. All right, so those are the kinds of neurons, and probably, I don't know if these are exam figures right here, but they might be. So since this is a physiology class, right, if I show you a picture of this, I'm probably not going to ask you for the name because that's really old. You get bored taking a test like that. I'd ask you what the function of this neuron is, right? So it's going to be what, association neuron or a motor neuron, for instance. Oh, there's something that I forgot to mention. I'm going to go back a slide. Okay. So also on this slide, we see these bottom two pathways. And can you tell me something about this neuron right here? What kind of neuron is it? They're different because you could tell me in terms of anatomy or in terms of physiology, and at the moment I don't care because my next question would be the other one. So what can you tell me about this neuron right here? It is motor. Yeah, it's a motor neuron. All right, so that's the function. What about the anatomy of it? What kind by structure? It's a multipolar neuron. All right, and how many do you see from the central nervous system to where it reaches a skeletal muscle? You just see one, right? And so this is the kind of motor neuron that goes to skeletal muscle. So that, what can you tell me about skeletal muscle? Is it voluntary or involuntary? It's voluntary. As a matter of fact, it's the only thing that you really have control of in your whole body is skeletal muscle. And we can see that it requires only one neuron to make up that whole pathway from the central nervous system to that effector organ. So hence, since this is a voluntary pathway with only one neuron, we call that a somatic motor neuron. Somatic means voluntary in this particular case. As opposed to this second pathway over here, again, I see some multipolar neurons, These are both motor neurons, but it's a different kind of pathway. We see two motor neurons back to back, and that's clearly an example of an autonomic pathway, right? An autonomic motor pathway. So the difference between these two motor pathways is that one is voluntary and the other is involuntary. One is somatic, the other is what we call autonomic, right? So autonomic is an involuntary pathway. And furthermore, from anatomy, what could you tell me about autonomic pathways? How many are there in your body? How many general different kinds, general divisions of an autonomic pathway are there? Okay. Well, these are the effector organs, right? Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. This is everything else besides skeletal muscle. So these are things that you cannot control in your body. They're controlled automatically for you via the autonomic nervous system. And how many divisions of the autonomic nervous system are there? How many different kinds of nerves go to your heart, for instance? Now, your heart can contract all by itself, right? If we were to take a heart out of a frog or mouse or anybody, like if they wanted to work on the heart outside their body, just take it out, it's still going to beat, right? But innervation to that heart is just going to adjust how fast it beats and the force of contraction, right? So how many different divisions of the autonomic nervous system go to the heart to control its rhythm, its rate, and its force of contraction? No? Okay. Well, actually, we talked about this in the first lab. The autonomic nervous system has two divisions. There's the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. And on the heart, the sympathetic division speeds it up, and the parasympathetic slows it down. Okay? So that's what we mean by autonomic. Okay. So we've covered that. All right, support cells. In the peripheral nervous system, there are two kinds of cells. And the first kind, we see, wraps itself around this axon right here. So we find it in the peripheral nervous system wrapping itself around axons, and we call these Schwann cells. And Schwann cells synthesize a chemical compound called myelin that is in these layers of the Schwann cell right up against the axon. And myelin is a lipid compound. And can water diffuse through a lipid? No, because it's hydrophobic, right? What about ions? Can ions diffuse through lipid? No, they can't because they're hydrophilic as well, and a lipid is hydrophobic. So myelin acts as an insulator around this axon. It prevents leaks of ions from either entering or exiting this axon right here. And remember, an ion has electrical charge on it, so it's preventing the leakage of electrical charge from this axon. It acts like insulation on a regular wire. So wires that you have in the wall, you could probably touch as long as it had, what, insulation on a plastic or rubber or something. And so that's pretty much the job that these Schwann cells are producing as well. All right, it prevents leakage of electrical currents, except that these little junctions between the Schwann cells. So I see one, two, I see four Schwann cells in this particular diagram. There's a space between them. What do we call that space between them? That's a node of Ranvier, for instance. And this is the only area where electrical currents can leak out of an axon. So when an axon is transmitting an impulse, currents need to move out of the axon. Charges have to change places with the extracellular fluid and the interior fluid of the axon. But when it's myelinated like this, it can only happen at these nodes of Ranvier. So let's pretend there aren't any Schwann cells right here, that it's just a nice continuous membrane. In order for an electrical impulse to move down an axon that is not myelinated, then every single molecule has to convey that electrical information. And there are trillions of molecules from the cell body down to the axon terminus, right? So that takes a long time for that electrical signal, relatively long period of time for that electrical signal to reach the axon terminus. But if it is a myelinated axon like we have right here, that electrical signal can actually hop from one node to the next, to the next, to the next, down the axon, and that's a much faster way of transmitting that electrical information. So myelinated axons are much faster compared to non-myelinated axons because the signal actually hops from node to node. One way for you to think of this, perhaps, is to think that you're on a flight of stairs, and there's maybe 100 stairs that you have to walk down, but you're in a hurry, so you're going to run down the stairs. Okay? So if you're running down the stairs, what would be faster? Step on every single stair on the way down as fast as you can, or maybe hop every third stair. What would be faster? And just pretend you're in good enough shape, you're not going to get tired and fall and crash. Okay? What would be faster, running down the stairs? Stepping on every single stair or hopping every third stair? Hopping is a lot faster, right? Same thing for the speed of conduction of an electrical impulse. When it can hop, it's a lot faster, and so that's an advantage for this particular neuron for communicating. The faster neurons communicate through their effector organs, right, that's definitely a nice evolutionary advantage. You can run faster, get out of the way of things faster, you can catch things faster. And the way that we talk about that conduction of the nerve impulse is if it is hopping, we call that saltatory conduction. So saltatory means hopping. And if it can't hop, then it's going to go continuously from one molecule to the next. We call that continuous conduction. So which kind of conduction is faster, saltatory or continuous? Saltatory is definitely faster. All right, and an axon can produce or can produce saltatory conduction if it is what? Myelinated, if it has these Schwann cells. So Schwann cells are what we find in the peripheral nervous system. We do not find them in the central nervous system. And again, it gives this axon kind of a whitish color to it, gives it kind of a white creamy color. These Schwann cells, the way they lay down this myelin sheath is just by wrapping themselves around the axon many numerous times. And eventually the cytoplasm ends up in the outer layer, and here you can see the nucleus of the Schwann cell. But of course, the cytoplasm has salt in it, that's conductive, but all these inner layers right here are filled with that lipid compound, which we call myelin, right, the insulating material. Sometimes this outer layer that contains the cytoplasm, we call that the neurilemma of the Schwann cell. The other kinds of cells that we see in the peripheral nervous system, which are not diagrammed here, are satellite cells. These are neuroglia cells that we find surrounding the soma of a axon, or of a the soma of a multipolar neuron, or even a unipolar neuron. So you would maybe just see all kinds of nuclei surrounding this big cell right here. That would be a satellite cell. Okay, in the central nervous system, we have a few more kinds of cells. And so here is, what is this, yellow, gold?
Yellow.
Yellow, this yellow cell again is the neuron. And these look like nice multipolar neurons right here. So I see dendrites, and here is a nice long axon going someplace. Here's a second neuron with an axon going someplace. And we can see a myelin sheath around these axons as well. Right? There's one here, and there's one here. And what is the space between these myelin wrappings called? That's a node of Ron VA once again. So this kind of axon is going to allow for what kind of conduction? Saltatory conduction, which is fast. Right? But now these cells are not Schwann cells. Notice that their structure is a lot different. Okay? They're not just wrapped around in one location, but the very many different kinds of processes, right, can wrap in different locations on one nerve, and they can even reach out and touch another neuron. And so these we call oligodendrocytes. Oligodendrocytes produce myelin sheaths in the central nervous system. The other kinds of cells that I see that are neuroglia cells are the microglia. The microglia are disease-fighting cells. They're immune cells, self-defense cells. So they're crawling around inside our brains all the time looking for old and damaged material, blood clots. They can even help fight tumors that start to grow in our brains under the right conditions. Right? So the microglia are the immune cells. And then another kind of cell that I see, we got two more. Another kind is what we call an astrocyte. And an astrocyte was named because when people first started looking at them, they kind of looked like a shining star with a bunch of rays coming out of it. Okay? And an astrocyte has these many processes. Some of the processes are touching the soma of a neuron, and the other processes are touching a capillary right here. So they act as a bridge. They're going to have a number of different functions that we talk about, but one of the functions is that they act as a bridge carrying chemicals from the blood directly to this neuron over here, speeding the transport of these molecules. So what molecule do you think this neuron would like to have that's in the blood? Yep, oxygen might be one. Okay, oxygen diffuses pretty fast, but the neuron is actually going to make ATP, but what does it need to make ATP? It needs glucose. So astrocytes actually actively transport glucose from this blood in the capillary into the neuron right here. So it acts as a really nice bridge or pathway. Yeah. An immune cell, immune, self-defense, right? And all these different these processes from the astrocyte, we call these perivascular feet because they surround a capillary, and they might actually completely surround a capillary. There's spaces between them, but these perivascular feet also form something very special that the brain has that other capillary systems in your body don't have. There's something called the blood-brain barrier. So the blood-brain barrier is special because these neurons are active all the time. As a matter of fact, if we cut off oxygen to these neurons, how many moments of consciousness do you have? You have about, 2 to 4 seconds, something like that. You'll lose consciousness. So these neurons are highly active, even when you're sleeping, are highly active all the time, regulating your body. Remember, most of the things in your body you don't control, these neurons control automatically for you. So they're very important in maintaining your life homeostasis. And many things that we eat and drink are fairly toxic to these neurons. And if they were to diffuse out, okay, then we probably wouldn't live very long. So there's a special barrier that protects these neurons from all kinds of things that are in the blood. And we call that the blood-brain barrier, and the blood-brain barrier is formed by astrocytes. And sometimes it's kind of a problem because we might have a nice pharmaceutical agent that we wish to give somebody for these neurons inside the brain, but these pharmaceutical agents can't get across the blood-brain barrier, right? So that's definitely a problem. So then those drugs have to be re-engineered, modified somehow chemically, so that they can get across the blood-brain barrier and actually enter the brain where we want them to have some kind of beneficial effect. Okay, so, but nonetheless, the blood-brain barrier is very important for protecting our brain cells. And then the last kind of cell that we see are these ependymal cells. And the ependymal cells line cavities that are inside the brain. Can anybody name some cavities that are inside the brain for me? Or we don't have, or are you going to tell me we don't have cavities inside our brain? We have cavities in teeth. I know we have cavities in teeth too. But there are big cavities inside our brain that help give our brain its shape and protect it from trauma, okay, and help kind of inflate our brain. There's even a flow between the different chambers, right? What are these chambers called? Oh, come on, you guys. Come on. Use your brain. They're called, the lobes are actually the neurons, the neuronal tissue, but deep inside the lobes, there are what we call the ventricles. You're going to start groaning because you know that, right? So you have the lateral ventricles and the third ventricle, fourth ventricle. They're big spaces inside the brain. These like porpoise-shaped things, the lateral ones, right? The first and second, which we call the lateral, are those. That's in a bone. Medullary cavity is in a bone, but that's kind of close because the brain has a medulla, and the cavity inside the medulla is actually the fourth ventricle. Okay, so maybe you guys got to pull your fun anatomy books out and take a look at the ventricular system again. All right, but there's not air inside the ventricles. What's inside the ventricles? There's a fluid. Yeah, there's a fluid. Yeah, cerebral spinal fluid. And that cerebral spinal fluid is sort of like blood plasma. And these ependymal cells line all the ventricles. And in a couple places, like the roof of the third ventricle and in the fourth ventricles, the roof of the fourth ventricle, and even a couple places in the lateral ventricles, there are some capillaries that are associated with these ependymal cells. And they produce cerebral spinal fluid. What's that kind of tissue that produces cerebral spinal fluid? Two words.
First letter.
First letter is C. And it start. And the first word is choroid.
Oh.
What's the second word?
The
choroid plexus. The choroid plexus makes cerebrospinal fluid. So these ependymal cells make the choroid plexes and those different locations of the brain, as well as just making up the layer, right, that separates the cerebrospinal fluid from your neuronal tissue inside your brain. Okay, so that's the function of the ependymal cells. Yeah. Oligodendrocytes? Yeah, look, I got a picture right here. I got another good picture. Okay, so oligodendrocytes make myelin sheaths around axons, but in one location, in your central nervous system. So brain and spinal cord, not in the peripheral nervous system. What's the name of cells that make myelin sheaths in the peripheral nervous system? The Schwann cells, right? And Schwann cells are just single cells. Oligodendrocytes have, these many processes, so they can form myelin around many axons, not just one. And I don't think anybody knows if these allow for communication between these different neurons or modify the activity of these different neurons. Probably not, but who knows? Maybe sometime during your life you'll learn that these oligodendrocytes have some kind of special function, right, moderating the function between all these different neurons. But we don't really know that at this point in time. All right, so you can see a myelin sheath right here. So what kind of conduction speed do we have on these axons? Fast or relatively slow?
Fast,
right, because it's saltatory conduction. That conduction is hopping from one node to the next. Okay, we talked about the ependymal cells already. Here is how a Schwann cell just wraps itself around an axon, and the cytoplasm of the Schwann cells ends up in the outermost coat, the most superficial space right here, and we call that the neurilemma. All right, but nonetheless, all the myelin, the insulating material, is very close to the axon. And that electrically insulates the axon. All right, we talked about that one already. Axon regeneration occurs much more readily in the peripheral nervous system than the central nervous system. Probably you all kind of know that already. Like if there's a spinal cord injury, you're stuck for life, right? You have an impasse there. Those neurons don't regenerate, and they don't know how to connect back up with each other. And one of the reasons why that is because of the job of the oligodendrocytes. They produce proteins that inhibit regrowth. So these are the cells that prevent regrowth. So it'd be really nice to figure out a way how to prevent these oligodendrocytes from producing these proteins. Okay? But there's probably a really good reasons why oligodendrocytes produce those proteins in the first place. So if we're going to defeat that protection purpose, we have to do it in the right way. So, for instance, we don't just produce a big neuroma, big neural tumor in somebody, right? We want those original pathways back. Okay. So when the central nervous system is damaged, these oligodendrocytes just form a scar tissue that blocks the regrowth. Excuse me a second. I'm going to have a drink. All right, that menthol lyptus is really good stuff. As long as I don't inhale the cough drop when I cough. But somebody in here knows CPR, right? All right, good. But hopefully. But I'm sure I won't need it. Let's see, do they have any instructions on here? Oh, yeah, it says, use with adult supervision. Okay. Don't give them to kids that are coughing, because they'll inhale them. Okay. But nerve regeneration in the peripheral nervous system is different, and sometimes there are some very nice successful stories, because if we have a nerve that's cut, okay, the cellular debris of the Schwann cells, these Schwann cells or these cell fragments don't die, right? This neuron doesn't die. There's an inflammatory, initial inflammatory process Okay, but the neuron survives, and the Schwann cells survive, and they regenerate and form a tube from the site of the injury all the way back to the effector organ. And that tube we call a regeneration tube, and then that guides the growth of the axon back to the effector organ, to what we call the synaptic site. So sometimes peripheral nerves do regenerate themselves very, very nicely, and that's why we can, for instance, reattach hands and fingers and things like that, right? And those nerves will regrow to that effector organ via this, what, regeneration tube. Can't do that with the spinal cord because they don't have Schwann cells in the spinal cord. Neurotropins are chemical compounds that promote fetal nerve growth, so the brain definitely has to grow in the neonate, right? And even the adolescent, I think, everybody's brain really doesn't mature until they're in their 20s sometime. but we also are beginning to realize that these neurotropins are required for survival of many adult neurons as well. And even more importantly, our understanding has changed pretty much drastically because the initial understanding of regeneration of neurons in the central nervous system is what? Is that they don't ever regenerate. They don't ever repair themselves. But we now know that that's really not really the case. That even in the adult, our brains are restructuring themselves and growing all the time. And we never did talk much about bones in here, but in anatomy, maybe you could think back to bone. And is a bone a living tissue in your body, or is it kind of a dead tissue? I mean, is it like this cement that's in a wall, or what is it doing? It's a living tissue, right? There are osteocytes in bone, and there are osteoclasts and osteoblasts that build up bone and break bone down, and they're always in balance, right? So how long does your skeleton last for? Or another way of asking it is, how quickly does it turn over? Because the skeleton that you have right now is not the skeleton that you had a certain time ago. And that certain time ago is actually what I'm trying to have you think about. How long does your skeleton last? Okay. I'm not quite sure I heard you. My ears must be plugged up too. But that your skeleton turns over every 5 years. It's completely rebuilt, right? So that's a very active, highly metabolic area. Your brain cells don't turn over that fast. As a matter of fact, they might last your whole lifetime. But what we're realizing is that just like a muscle, right, when you exercise a muscle, what happens to a muscle? It gets bigger and stronger. And when you exercise your brain, it doesn't necessarily get any bigger because it's stuck inside the cranium. But the way that neurons connect up with each other changes, right? So the network changes. So the processes, where they go inside the brain and what other cells they communicate with, changes quite drastically. And that's a process of learning. So these neurotropins are important for have your brain cells connect up in new and novel ways, which is one of the ways that we understand learning. Yeah. Question. Yeah, as far as we know right now, there are critical times in development, like age 1, age 2, age 3, where certain connections have to be made in order for you to have that kind of function later on in life. And if you miss one of those stages, then you might not have the exact same function. And I guess a pretty good example of that, I can't remember exactly, but where do you perceive vision? Where is your sense of vision at? Okay, but in your brain, what part of your brain is responsible for vision? That is your occipital lobe in the back, okay? Well, there was a person that had some kind of congenital abnormality with his eye, so it wasn't perceiving light, I believe, or there was damage, some kind of trauma to the eye, and they grew up not seeing anything. And then later on in his life, they figured out how to correct that condition, and he was able to see, okay? But because he never went through those developmental stages of making all the correct connections to the occipital lobe, right, he can't see today like how somebody that's normally sighted, right? That he can't maybe see faces or printed words or something. I mean, his eye sees the exact same things that we see, but the connections in the brain just weren't developed. So, you know, everything is kind of blurry or fuzzy or something. And so the appreciation of the world is totally different. But of course, he's much better off being able to see something rather than what? Nothing at all, right? And maybe during his lifetime, you know, he'll be able to order the his environment around him. He'll learn how to see, but not as quickly as somebody who went through the natural process of learning how to see, which is kind of interesting. Okay, so neurotropins are really important for what I call remodeling of the brain. And that happens drastically. And when you take a class like this, right, that is kind of rigorous, right? So you have to learn all kinds of new things. And you just can't learn all these new things overnight. Because what has to happen to your brain? It actually has to grow and develop just like a weightlifter, right? The new connections have to be made. And a lot of times, hopefully a class is easier toward the end than at the beginning, because your brain is already growing and remodeling and rebuilding itself. It's actually sometimes that actually kind of scares some people that, you know, instructors are actually changing the shape of your brain in there. All right, but it's not just me, it's all the books and all the other good studying that you do. And the cells that we believe are doing most of this are the astrocytes. All right, it's not only it's the most common. It's important in buffering potassium levels and recycling neurotransmitters. So here we have a synapse that's releasing a neurotransmitter. It's going to have an effect on this postsynaptic cell. And one way that the neurotransmitter is modulated is that it is taken up by the astrocyte, thereby preventing the effects on this postsynaptic cell over here. And it's important for what we call neurogenesis. Neurogenesis is what? The remodeling of your brain as it's growing to understand and perform other different kinds of functions. So if you want to keep a young brain, what should you do with it as you get into your 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s? You've got to exercise it, right? Learn new languages or different musical instruments or take a physiology class again or something. I'm not sure what you want to do. Okay, but that's how you keep a nice, young, active brain is by using it, right? Practice using it. Okay, so that is the astrocyte. And then we talked about the blood-brain barrier already. That is also produced by astrocytes. All right. Now we get to membrane potential. What can you tell me about a potential again? What is a potential? It's a voltage, right? It's some kind of separation of charge across the membrane. So this could just as easily have been written membrane voltage, but we just call it potential. And so every cell acts like a battery. How many terminals does a battery have? It has two. Right, and so when we think of this membrane potential, we have to measure the difference in voltage between two places. And on a battery, it's the two terminals. But on a cell, what are the two places? It doesn't have like terminals sticking out. It is just from the outside of the cell compared to the inside. So the outer surface of the membrane is like one terminal of a battery. The inner surface of the membrane is the second terminal. And you can use a voltmeter to measure what that voltage is. As long as that cell is alive, it's going to have a voltage on it. And we looked at the resting membrane potential, how it's developed. We said it's due to what, the sodium-potassium pump and the anions that are inside the cell. And the difference in concentration of various ions across the membrane, like which one is highest on the outside? That's sodium. Which one is highest on the inside?
Potassium.
Right. Okay. So that's the resting membrane potential. It's negative on the inside, and these are some of the reasons why it is developed. We just said because of the large anions that are trapped inside the cell. Oh, I never noticed that before. Large anions. Maybe I did realize that last semester. Okay. So, and what are the large anions? Those are the nucleic acids and proteins and things like that that can't get through the cell membrane. Right, the sodium-potassium pump. And potassium is very permeable. So that also has a tendency to make the inside negative, because if we have this cell over here. All right, so the outside is what kind of charge? Positively charged, right? And the inside is negatively charged. And that slide right there says that potassium can actually leak through. There's actually some channels right here, right? That potassium can leak through. Sodium can't leak through very easily, but potassium can. So if potassium leaks out, what does that do to the voltage inside the cell? Does it make it more negative or more positive or no change in the voltage? More negative, right? So that helps maintain the inside of the cell more negative compared to the outside because potassium can leak out. Okay, we call that permeability. So that is a positive charge in motion across the membrane. That is really an electrical current. So the permeability of this membrane to potassium produces an electrical current, which changes the state of charge on the membrane. Okay, so cells are excitable. They can discharge their resting membrane potential quickly by rapid changes in permeability to ions. Now, how can ions get through a membrane? What did I show you right here? There's got to be some kind of channel. Because this is hydrophilic, it can't get through that big hydrophobic region inside the membrane. It's a barrier. There's got to be some kind of pathway, right, like a foramen through this membrane, and that's due to what we call a channel. We've got a couple kinds of channels in cell membranes. And the first kind is what we call a ligand-gated channel. And the second kind is a voltage-gated channel. All right, so you know what a channel is. It's just a passageway so that these hydrophilic compounds can move across the membrane. What does a gate mean? I'm going to make this a little bit bigger so that we can see it. All right, so here is that protein. That's a channel. A gate just means that it's maybe not always open. Sometimes, right, the gate is closed. And when the gate's closed, that ion can't go through. At other times, the gate can open up, and then ions can move through the channel. And there are different ways that this gate is controlled. Sometimes it's controlled by a ligand, and a ligand comes from the word ligature. Ligature is like what to... is like to bind together, like to tie together or something. So a ligand is another kind of molecule, like this one, that can bind to this channel and cause the gate to open or close. That would be a ligand-gated channel. Other kinds of channels, over like I'm going to draw right over here, looks kind of similar, right, can open or close depending on the voltage of the membrane. It's not going to be determined by when something binds to this channel, but just the voltage. So for instance, okay, maybe the voltage is going to look like this at some point in time. And we're going to see that happening. So the voltage changes on the membrane, and that can pull and push on the protein to change conformation to open up the channel. Okay, and neurons and muscles do this to generate and conduct impulses. So we say neurons and muscles are excitable because they can regulate the voltage on their membranes. Okay, so let's look at some changes in membrane potential. And down over here, we have a real fancy oscilloscope. An oscilloscope can measure voltage by a vertical deflection of a little light beam. And then this is just a little time axis. So this little light beam is always just moving across the screen like this as a time axis, right? And then we can measure voltage. So don't forget, here is zero. Right? So here is zero voltage. Anything below zero is negative. Everything above zero is a positive voltage. Okay, and every kind of voltmeter, whether it's an oscilloscope or just a digital meter or whatever, how many different electrodes does it need to have? Okay, because how many terminals does a battery have? It's got two. All right, so it needs to have two terminals or two electrodes. So here are the two electrodes coming out of this fancy voltmeter that we can see. All right. And one of the electrodes goes inside the cell, and the other one we keep outside the cell. And therefore, we can measure the potential difference or the voltage across the membrane. And these little electrodes, do you think they're really hard to make or easy to make? You know what? They're really easy to make. I made lots of them. Because you want to know how to make them? Sort of interested, not too interested. But if you take some glass tubing, right, a little glass tube with a hole in it, probably you're going to use some of these in the physiology lab, and you put that glass tube in a Bunsen burner, what's going to happen to the glass? It's going to get kind of fluidy, right? It's going to kind of sag a little bit. So after the glass is sort of melted but the tube hasn't shut, if you pull it, okay, the tube gets really, really small and before it breaks. Right, so if you pull it, it gets really, really small. It gets so small that it's microscopic, actually. And then if you look at it underneath a microscope, you can actually put it inside of a cell. And if you put salt water inside that tube, then that will conduct electricity, and that's just a little electrode that you can actually place inside of a cell. So that's how they make these little micropipettes, for instance, for in vitro fertilization, where you need to inject some DNA into a cell. You just pull a glass rod real quick and it breaks and it's just really, really, really tiny. It's a little dangerous because what can you tell me about the end of that little glass tip, that glass rod with a hole in it? You can't see it, right? So when you're carrying it around the room, you can't see it. You've got to be really careful that you don't poke yourself with it, right, in your arm or finger, because that glass won't ever dissolve away, or your eye or something. So you got to be careful with those little micro pipettes. So anyway, we can stick one little micropipette in here that has a salt solution in it and record the voltage. And we can change the resting membrane potential. When the membrane potential, well, what's a resting membrane potential? A typical good round ballpark figure would be, can you see it on the slide right here? About minus 70, right? It's minus on the inside compared to the outside. All right, so if we stimulate this cell, then the voltage of the cell is going to go from minus 70 up towards zero, right? So that voltage is doing what? It is, different ways we can talk about it, it's becoming more positive, or it's going to zero, it's going away when it's going to zero. We call that depolarization. So depolarization is a stimulus. Furthermore, we could actually cause the resting membrane potential to become more negative. Oh, I can't even read that word because of the color, but I could guess what it says. Okay. We can make this voltage what? Bigger and bigger and bigger. Minus 80, minus 90, minus 100. Right? And we would call that hyperpolarization, making the voltage bigger, making it more negative than the resting membrane potential. All right? So that's hyperpolarization. And that is inhibitory. That's an inhibitory stimulus on this neuron. Furthermore, the third state that we're going to talk about is if we depolarize a neuron by stimulating it, right, it will go back to its resting membrane potential. And going from a depolarized state to the resting membrane potential, that's what we call repolarization. So we got these three terms. Right, depolarization is when the RMP goes to zero. It might even overshoot a little bit. When it goes back down to RMP, that's repolarization. And if it gets lower than RMP, then we call that hyperpolarization. Okay, so these are the three terms that we're going to use. Okay, so membrane potential changes occur by flow of what? Ions through the membrane channels. Like, for instance, if we let calcium leak out, what's going to happen to the inside of the cell? It's going to it's going to become more negative, right? It's going to hyperpolarize or repolarize. Some channels are normally open, some are closed, but these potassium channels, what we call leak channels, they're always open. Other kinds of channels have gates on them that can open or close. And here are the two different kinds, right? The ligand-gated or voltage-gated channels. A voltage-gated channel are opened by depolarization. So what's depolarization again? That's when the voltage goes from RMP up to zero, and as the cell membrane voltage changes up to zero, some voltage-gated channels are going to open. in particular, let's look at this. Let's just say that at this point in time, right here, there is a sodium channel that opens up when the membrane voltage gets to minus 50. All right, so there, that's a voltage-gated channel for sodium right here. And the membrane potential is reached minus 50, and this gate opens up. Okay, which way does the sodium want to go? Does it want to go in or out? It wants to go in. Why does it want to go in? There's two reasons. Because concentration, right? It's high out here, and what's it in here? Low. Just by concentration. There's another reason. You see another reason? Because this is a cation, it's going to be attracted inside the cell because this negative charge, right, attracts the sodium's positive charge. So when this voltage gate opens, sodium rushes in the cell. And when it rushes in, what happens to the voltage inside the cell? It becomes more positive. That's right. So when sodium goes inside the cell, then it depolarizes what? Even more. It depolarizes even more, even faster. Okay, up to a point. And we're going to see what some of those points are. Okay. So voltage-gated potassium channels are closed in resting cells, and even the sodium channels, okay, are closed in resting cells. And the sodium channels will open when the cell is stimulated, if it reaches a certain voltage. So a good way to think of a voltage or a sodium channel, a voltage-gated sodium channel, is the following. Here we have a nice phospholipid bilayer. Ions can't get through it because of this hydrophobic region right here. Normally, can sodium move across this channel in the resting membrane? No, because it is what? It's all just puckered closed, right? There's no way for a molecule to get through here. But, okay, under certain conditions, when the cell begins to depolarize, this protein right here is pulled and tugged in different ways because the charge changes across the membrane, and now it's open. And if it's open, sodium can enter the cell. Okay, so sodium enters the cell, but then you also see another thing right here, this little ball and chain. This is what we call an inactivation gate. When the membrane voltage gets positive, maybe positive 40, maybe 50, maybe 60, okay, on some cells, depending on the cell, this inactivation gate moves up into this location right here, and what happens? The channel is effectively closed. Even though this protein right here hasn't reset itself, hasn't gone to a closed conformation, this inactivation gate prevents further entry of sodium inside the cell. So if sodium can't get inside the cell, what can you tell me about the membrane potential at that point? If sodium is going in, right, if sodium is going in the cell, what's happening to the voltage inside the cell? Becoming more positive. And when that little ball and chain closes the channel, can the cell get any more positive? Nope. Then sodium can't get inside. So that's what I want you to see with that little ball and chain right there. Okay. All right, so this takes us to the next topic of an action potential. All right, so what does RMP mean? Resting membrane potential. That means things really aren't changing. There's a little bit of a leak of potassium out of the cell, but things really aren't changing. The membrane potential is what? Just a steady minus 70 millivolts. So resting membrane potential, we could call it a steady potential. It's not changing. As opposed to action potential. What does that mean? It's fun, right? There's action going on there. All right? Things are changing. Ions are moving. Different channels are opening and closing. All right? So, action potential. This is what you pay your money to see, right? The action potential. Well, here is our first slide of an action potential. And we're going to focus on the illustration on the right-hand side, the top right-hand side of this slide. We have a plot of membrane potential or membrane voltage, right, from inside to outside in millivolts versus time. And on this slide, we see that its resting membrane potential is what? Minus 70 millivolts. and it's proceeding in time. And at this point in time, right at time zero right here, we issue a stimulus to that muscle. And that stimulus is going to cause a slow depolarization. Now, what kind of stimulus could you think of that would cause a slow depolarization right here? What molecule could you use, and how would you move it across the membrane to cause a cell to depolarize? You could use what? A little bit of sodium and drag it inside the cell, or let it flow inside the cell. And when it does, what's going to happen to this membrane potential? It's going to become more positive. And can you see that membrane potential here getting more positive? You see that right there? Okay. So the other thing that you see on this slide is this dotted line. This is what we call threshold voltage. And when the stimulus reaches the threshold voltage right here, which looks to be about minus 55 on this slide, then something happens. Something is triggered. What is triggered are these voltage-gated channels. The threshold stimulus has been reached, and these, and in particular, sodium voltage-gated channels open up right here. And so now we have a bunch of channels for sodium opening up. What does sodium do? It goes inside the cell because of this concentration gradient and because of the electrical gradient. All right? And it happens very fast because both gradients are working in the same direction. So whenever you have that voltage going in the upward direction, what do we call that, depolarization or repolarization? That's depolarization. So this is the first phase of an action potential. We call it depolarization, and that is due to sodium doing what? Going from outside the cell to inside the cell via these channels, and the most important channels to think of here are the voltage-gated channels because the cell membrane potential has reached this particular voltage, which opens all these channels up. And as a matter of fact, as the voltage gets more positive and more positive, or less negative, more and more voltage-gated channels open up. And when more and more voltage-gated channels open up, then depolarization happens faster, which opens more channels, which happens faster. What does that sound like? That causes like positive feedback, right? That's a positive feedback mechanism, which causes this huge, this very rapid change in membrane potential on the cell. So that's the first thing that happens. Okay. All right, then we see depolarization stops right here. Guess what that's due to? How could you abruptly stop sodium from entering the cell? That inactivation gate. Let's go back to that inactivation gate. So this thing changes state from open to closed. The inactivation gate closes right at the top of the action potential. So sodium can't enter the cell anymore. And if sodium can't enter the cell, what happens to depolarization? It stops. Bang, it just kind of just comes to an abrupt end. Okay. Well, something else is happening too that got triggered with this stimulus. Not only is it the sodium channels, the sodium voltage-gated channels get stimulated, but the potassium voltage-gated channels get stimulated as well. But the potassium voltage-gated channels are slow to open up. All right, so as the cell is depolarized, and let me erase all of these little symbols right here, what's the voltage now at the top of this action potential? It's what? As a matter of fact, it's positive. What was it when we started? Minus. So it's already gone positive. So now the inside of the cell looks like what? It's positive. And the outside is negative. As strange as it seems, that happens. And what do we have? We have now the sodium gates closed, and this potassium gate is now open. All right, so what can you tell me about potassium? What does it want to do? What is potassium inside the cell? It's high inside the cell and low outside the cell. So it wants to do what? It wants to go from high to low because of concentration gradient. It also wants to go from inside to outside. Why? Because now the electrical gradient is moving it outside the cell as well. Okay. And so now you see this rapid, what do we call it when the voltage gets more negative all the time? That is repolarization, that is rapid because of the concentration gradient and the electrical potential, and it even overshoots the resting membrane potential, and when it gets even more negative than the resting membrane potential, we call that hyperpolarization. So this is repolarization and hyperpolarization. But I think for today, what I would like you to know is that this is the action potential, and it has two phases. There's the first phase and the second phase. What's the first phase? We call that depolarization. The second phase is repolarization. The first phase is due to sodium rushing inside the cell, and the second phase or repolarization is potassium leaving the cell. Okay. So that's how cells basically communicate with each other through little events like this. But don't forget about some of those other little things, that details that we were talking about, namely this stimulus right here. Okay, the stimulus has to reach threshold before an action potential takes place. And this other little phase of an action potential that we call this hyperpolarization, this produces what we call a relative refractory period. Because, for instance, take a look at this. So we needed this amount of voltage from the RMP to get the threshold to initiate this action potential. But after the action potential, when the membrane is hyperpolarized, if we give the same stimulus right here, will it cause another action potential? So if we're going to add this voltage to this hyperpolarization, it's what? It's down here. See where my index finger is? It's not at the threshold. So in order to stimulate this neuron again, we can't use this stimulus, right? Because it's no longer strong enough. We need to, what kind of stimulus? A bigger stimulus to counteract that hyperpolarization, which is what? Bigger than the initial one. So that's what we call this a relative refractory period. We'll use that.
So the hyperpolarization is on the bottom of this?
Yep, hyperpolarization. It produces a relative refractory period. That means that you need a stronger stimulus than usual to excite that neuron again during that time when the membrane is hyperpolarized. After that time when the membrane is hyperpolarized, like right here, what kind of stimulus do you need? Just like you had initially, right? That's fine. But over here, you need what? An additional stimulus to overcome that area, that hyperpolarization that produces a relative refractory period. Okay, so on the left-hand side of this slide just shows you basically what we were kind of talking about, that if the depolarization stimulus, right, that's going to, if it reaches threshold, that's going to open up a sodium-gated, a voltage-gated sodium channel, and sodium diffuses into the cell that causes more depolarization, that causes more voltage-gated channels to open for sodium, which causes more sodium to enter. So this is that positive feedback that causes what? This rapid rise in the membrane potential, which we call depolarization. And this bottom square down over here just says that, you know what? Right here at the stimulus, both gates are activated, both the sodium and the potassium. Okay, but these potassium gates right here are slow. They're just slow to become activated. They're still triggered at the exact same time, but they're slow to open up. And there is something that's almost universally true in physiology and nature, and that is, if something has a very fast onset of action, its duration, especially in the body, is very, very short. So if something takes effect immediately, its duration is relatively short. But if but drugs, for instance, that take a long time to have an effect, their duration is very, very long. Good examples of these would be barbiturates. There are some barbiturates you'll be under the influence of in just a matter of a second and a half. But the duration of that drug will be very short. Other barbiturates might take a half hour for their onset of action, but their duration will be really, really long. So I want you to make that analogy with these different gates, the sodium versus the potassium channel. Right? The sodium is very fast, but its duration is really short. The potassium is slow, but its duration is relatively long. And it even produces what? This area right here of hyperpolarization, because its duration is long. It has a longer act. All right, so that's kind of the action potential in a nutshell. All right, the action potential is a wave of membrane potential changes that sweep along the axon from soma to synapse. The wave is formed by rapid depolarization of the membrane by sodium influx followed by rapid repolarization. I don't think we have a picture, so I'm going to draw maybe another little picture on the board. So remember, we have this neuron right here with dendrites coming out and this nice long axon going down to these axon terminals right here. In this part of the neuron right here, we have these voltage-gated channels. And there's one here, you know, there's one here, one here, one here. So when this area depolarizes, that acts as the stimulus for opening this channel. And when this one depolarizes, this area of the membrane depolarizes, that acts as a stimulus for opening this channel, this voltage-gated channel, which acts as a stimulus for this one. All right, so here we have an action potential right here, and it's going to do what? It's going to cause all these other voltage-gated channels to open until we get down to the axon terminus, and guess what the action potential looks like over here? Exactly the same as it did over here. It doesn't change. This axon could be a million miles long, and the action potential will look exactly the same. We call that without decrement. That's really one of the marvelous things about a neuron. It doesn't lose its signal intensity from this part of a neuron to the axon terminus. Now, what can you remember what this part of the neuron was called? That is called, this is the soma here. Okay, this is the, axon hillock. All right, the axon hillock, functionally we call this the trigger zone because this is where we first see voltage-gated channels. We don't see any voltage-gated channels here. We see ligand-gated channels over here. So this is the part of the neuron that is receiving signals, namely ligand. Something is going to bind to receptors in this part of the membrane that is going to cause a stimulus. And if that stimulus is strong enough, it reaches threshold here in the trigger zone, then that's going to cause an action potential. And as soon as you get an action potential, what's going to happen? It's going to shoot down the axon because it's self-propagating. Furthermore, if you have Schwann cells on this axon, then this can do what? It can hop down the axon even be faster. Okay? But these action potentials at the beginning or at the proximal end of an axon are going to be identical to the action potentials at the distal end without decrement. Okay, so I think we talked about this. This is an exam figure, and you know what? Probably over the weekend, you just might want to draw it out just to become familiar with it. Okay? I know you got to study for your test on Tuesday, but you probably want to just draw this out from memory a couple times. Okay? And so, you know, say, well, we got resting membrane potential, we got the threshold stimulus. How would you describe what's happening with the stimulus? Somehow, sodium is going to enter the cell, cause it to depolarize, in particular these ligand-gated channels will cause this stimulus. And then you got this. This is what? The first phase, that's depolarization. That's due to sodium going in, the voltage-gated channels. This part right here is the repolarization, the potassium leaving, and you could probably follow the discussion that we had as to why that happens. And this area here, hyperpolarization. Okay, so sodium voltage-gated channels, potassium voltage-gated channels, the threshold voltage. All right, so this would be a good place for you to start for a week from tonight when we talk some more about neurophysiology. All right, so this is actually a really fun chapter. And then when you get back next time, I'll have you work on another illustration that's not in your book that kind of defines the neuron into its two different main areas, functional areas, receiving area versus the sending area of a neuron. Okay, have a great weekend.